everyone. Welcome to the Ephesus Irish Itinerary Podcast. Ephesus is the European Federation of Associations and Centres of Irish Studies, and the Ephesus Irish Itinerary usually sends Irish authors on real journeys across Europe, where they visit university towns and cities, read from their publications, play their music, present their work, and discuss it with European students, citizens, and all lovers of Irish culture. With the help of this interview podcast, we continue to bring together some of the best contemporary Irish authors and artists in conversation with leading Irish studies scholars from across Europe, even in times of corona. I am Katharina Renhack, the president of Ephesus and professor of English Literary Studies at the University of Wuppertal. I'm delighted to hand over to Hedwig Schwall today, former president and now project manager of Ephesus and professor of English literature at the KU Leuven in Belgium. Hedwig is currently preparing the second kaleidoscope project for Ephesus, which is entitled Europe and Ireland. She has also launched the fourth Ephesus Literature and Translation project for Bridget's Day earlier this week. In 2021, our Literature in Translation project invites scholars and students to translate selected texts by an enright. This project is led by Dr. Maria Gidewska in cooperation with Hedwig Schwall. Don't hesitate to check our Ephesus website for more information. Now, I'm really happy to announce that in today's podcast, we'll hear Hedwig in conversation with Lucy Caldwell.
Hi, Lucy, it's great to see you. And so I'll start by introducing you and your work. So you're born in Belfast, 1981. In rather the deep troubles, because it was the year of the hunger strikes, which resulted in 9 deaths. But apparently you had a peaceful upbringing, because I understand you went to a non-denominational school and you had a very good English teacher, Wendy Erskine. You then went to Cambridge and you ended up, of course, with first class honours from Queen's College, and you went on to Goldsmiths in London. But then with your first play at only 23 years of age, you already got a performance at the Edinburgh Festival Fringe. And the next year you were appointed writer on attachment to the National Theatre in London. You won the George Devine Award for Most Promising Playwright with your play Leaves. And from then on you were showered with prestigious prizes for your plays, like the Susan Smith Blackburn Prize, the BBC Stuart Parker Award. Druid Theatre Company performed your plays, Royal Court Theatre, Birmingham Repertory Theatre performed Notes to Future Self. You were also really brilliant at radio play, and the radio play Girl from Mars, which was broadcast by BBC Radio 4 in 2008, won the Irish Playwrights and Screenwriters Guild Award for Best Radio Play and the BBC's Richard Innison Award for Best Script for a writer new to radio. Then your first novel, Where They Were Missed, was set in Belfast. And again, I hope we will talk a lot about Belfast. It was shortlisted for the Dylan Thomas Prize, and it was compared to Ian McEwan's The Cement Garden. Your second novel, The Meeting Point, is about an Irish missionary couple, and I hope we will talk a little bit about religion later. It was published by Faber in 2011 and won the Dylan Thomas Prize, and that year you won the Rooney Prize. Many, many more prizes. The next novel was All the Beggars Riding, published in 2013, for which you got shortlisted and other prizes. And then come the short stories, and we will focus here on the short stories. I read that Escape Routes, which was one of the stories in Multitudes, was shortlisted again for the 2012 BBC International Short Story Award. And then in 2018, you became an FRSL, a Fellow of the Royal Society of Literature, which is at your age is again incredible. And then also in 2018, you brought out this Faber and Faber Anthology of New Irish Short Stories, which is brilliant. I mean, it really is magnificent material for any secondary school teacher or any tertiary education, because you really come across so many new writers who are absolutely brilliant. But then you really dived into short stories with Multitudes, published in 2016, and now Intimacies, which we hope to see in June 2021. And then I understand you have a new novel coming. So, sorry for the long introduction. Let's move to questions now. My first question would be, in Intimacies, we have stories which move from the you narrative to the she, to the I, to the we. Is that an intention?
Yes. Hedwig, thank you so much for the introduction. It's really lovely to talk to you. I feel it's such a strange, slightly out-of-body experience hearing everything listed all together. It feels slightly overwhelming. But I've always felt, since I studied Keats at A-level with Wendy Erskine, I always remember those lines from one of his sonnets, one of his last sonnets, if I should die before my pen should glean my teeming brain. And I always feel when I'm writing, there always does seem to be such urgency to the thing that I'm working on. Other things fall away. And I think I'm, in other aspects of life, I'm such an impatient person. And I'm always trying to tell myself to slow down and to take things slower but somehow all of that falls away when I'm working on the thing that I'm working on. That seems to matter more than anything, and time seems to slow down or to warp to accommodate everything that thing needs. Yes, I suppose with regard to your question about form and point of view in Intimacies, I first started using the second person when I was writing the stories of Multitudes. And it's a point of view that I find can annoy me more often than any other in fiction if it's used poorly. I sometimes find that it can be used in a very blundering and corralling sort of a way when it's presumptuous or when it makes assumptions of the reader. You know, you are this and you feel this. As a reader, if I'm reading that, I always sort of want to wriggle away from that. I bristle slightly. But when it's used really well, I think it can be, I think of things like Jay McInerney's Bright Lights, Big City, where there's a sense of disconnect, where you are not the kind of guy who finds himself in a place like this as it opens. It's that sense that your real life is going on elsewhere, or some part of you is narrating the experience that you're having. I found that really interesting. When I first read that, I think I was in my teens. Wow. And when I was writing the stories for Multitudes, I found that I've never been very good at writing the third person and the third person past tense. I think it's a playwright in me. I can ventriloquize, I can write first person narrator very easily. My first novel is first person present tense, a 6-year-old girl, and later on her 16-year-old self. And there's that sense of immediacy, and I find that for me there's a sense that I can lose myself in my characters and I can write vividly as them. Whereas if I'm writing the third person, I get tangled up in so many existential knots about who is the Lucy Caldwell that's doing this observing? Who am I to select and comment on behalf of what my characters are seeing? All sorts of stylistic questions seem to come into play that make me feel very, very uncomfortable, that make me feel very self-conscious.
Yeah.
And so for the stories of Multitudes, some of them are written from a first-person point of view, but I found that there were some stories where the characters were too distant from their own feelings, or too shut in, or too unable to usefully articulate what they were going through. And if I wrote the stories with a view, with a hindsight, you know, an older self growing up looking back, the story would lose something. And so I discovered that I could use the second person in a way that felt very intimate, and it positioned the story as something told between the part of the character narrating their life in their own head, or from the point of view of a possible future self. It made the conversation a dialogue that the reader was barely, the reader was placed in a position of extreme intimacy, I hoped, because the reader was almost overhearing something. The reader was almost eavesdropping. I wanted the sense that these conversations, these stories were so intimate that the reader could barely breathe, just needed to listen. And so I loved that form. Mm-hmm. And I found that it allowed me that greater intimacy for those stories. And then similarly in Intimacies, the second collection, again, 4 of the 11 stories are told in the second person. And I had to pull back because I could have done, the second person can feel very intense. And so I had to limit myself. I could have written more in that form.
Right. Yeah. Would it be right? I mean, when I read Multitudes, it read a bit like Dubliners, but in Belfast, and instead of men all the time, it was women. And because there's also this progress throughout the short stories from a young age to 13 to elder, etc. So I suppose it's a conscious choice that you always have women protagonists.
Yes. Do you know, when I first started writing, as people generally do, especially if they start young, I wrote what came naturally, and I grew up, I'm one of 3 sisters, and I went to all girls schools all my life, and I wrote mother-daughter relationships, and I wrote friendships, and when I started writing plays, actors would start to say to me, it's really unusual to have a play that has lots of roles for women, and to have plays that have roles for women that aren't relational characters. You know, the girlfriend of, or the wife of, or the love interest of, or whatever the case might be. And so I started becoming more aware of that. And it took me years before I could write those stories in Multitudes. Funnily, they are one of the first things I ever started to write. As I was writing my first novel, I wrote the first draft of it at university and went on to my master's at Goldsmiths to finish it. And at the same time at Goldsmiths, I had this vision for a collection of stories that would be very unified, that would be set in Belfast, that would be about girls and young women growing up. And they were no good. I finished a whole draft of this story cycle and they were no good. I just didn't have any of the technique to be able to pull off any of what I wanted to do. And so I put the story cycle aside, and every couple of years I would come back to it and see if I could make it work. And actually, of the stories published in Multitudes, there are 2 of them, Poison and Cypress Avenue, whose first drafts date back to that first collection when I was doing my master's, that I just couldn't quite let go of the idea. And every couple of years I'd come back and see if I was good enough to make it work yet, and I wasn't. But I love Dubliners. It's an extraordinary collection, and that was very consciously one of my models when I was writing Multitudes. I wanted my collection to have a real tightness, a tautness, a feeling of unity. I wanted almost, and here, you know, Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man comes in as well, because I wanted it to have that sense that it could almost be a cubist portrait of young womanhood. Mm-hmm. In Belfast, there's a way that it could have been published as a novel, almost. You know, incidental details change from story to story, whether the narrator has a brother or 2 sisters or is an only child, tiny things like that, but all of the stories could almost be told by the same narrator. None of the narrators are named in Multitudes or Intimacies, funnily, because it felt so artificial naming them. It felt as if we were so deeply within the consciousness of the point of view of the story or the narrator of the story, that it seemed somehow distancing to give them each, you know, a made-up name. And so all of them, in both collections, and the collections are very much sister collections, they're deliberately patterned, deliberately tight. And yes, owe that debt to Dubliners, and to, it took me a while, as well as having the technique to write them, it took me a while to trust that the stories I had to tell of growing up in Belfast at that time were worthy of being told, because they're not the sort of stories that you immediately hear or you think of when you think of Belfast at that time. And there's a sense that if you grow up in a time of conflict, it's almost as if it sucks the oxygen from the grand narrative, sucks the oxygen from all of the other little narratives. And so things get presented in a very stark way. And it is just as important, I think, from an artistic point of view, from a moral point of view, to insist on the importance of other stories that seem smaller, that seem less political, but in fact are just as important, you know, to keep those possibilities of ordinary lives at an extraordinary time open and alive is a very important thing. I think it took me a long time to realize that or to trust that.
Yeah, you say that the mother child or the family, these close family relations are as important, but I would almost say are more important, because the way in which you describe them is just so subtle. And I find it striking how you always choose words which have a lot of connotations and which give the reader a creative space, a space to work with the words and the sentences. And so the technique is like a toy for the reader. And that strikes me, because in infancies, it's all about mother-child relationships and degrees of life that is and is not quite yet. So could you say a bit more about the importance of family relationships?
Yes, of course. I'm a great fan of Jung and modern Jungian psychotherapy, and I'm fascinated by the extent to which especially sibling relationships shape us. There are some interesting writers today that say that our sibling relationships and our place in the family is as important as the parental relationship. And I'm fascinated by family dynamics. Say the family as a unit, when any family gets together, and it's been a long time since I've seen my parents because of this pandemic, and I've got a sister in Australia who doesn't look likely to leave anytime soon, and another sister who lives in London who I've seen just as little because of the lockdown. But I find it so interesting that when members of a family come together, or when someone in that family unit brings in a new partner or brings in someone else into that dynamic, the way we tell stories and we tell the same stories about who we are and how we came to be that way. I'm interested in the way that can be, you know, story is a repository of cultural memory, is as important, you know, a nation tells itself the stories of how it came to be and how it is the way it is. And I'm interested in the way that the family unit as well can trap you at a certain age or a certain place. I sometimes feel, maybe I've started not to feel it so much anymore, but for a long time I felt that when I went back home, I would become about 17 again. I'm the eldest of my three sisters. Maybe my sisters would disagree with this entirely, but I would always feel that I would slip back to not quite being an adult, but almost being an adult, but still being slightly a bullshy teenager, you know, and I might be a professional woman in my late 20s coming back with my husband. And still the family, it asserts such a magnetic power, you know. And I would feel there are times that I would come back. I've never lived in Belfast independently as an adult because I left when I was 18. The family house that I go back to is still the house that my parents moved into when I was 12. Still the same bedroom, although, you know, the posters are off the wall. But there's this sense that sometimes I would come back and feel, even after I'd had a child, that it was impossible that I had moved away. It was impossible I'd ever done anything. It was impossible that I'd had a child. And these things, of course, they're my own projections, and they're the subtle ways and the magnetic ways that family units work to protect themselves and to keep themselves in the way that they are. I'm fascinated by that. And also in the moments that allow change, allow those dynamics to be broken.
Yeah.
In my own writing, one of those moments was, there were sort of two parts to it. I had read, I just discovered the stories of Lucia Berlin, and she's extraordinary. She's one of my favorite writers. What she does with sentences, it's jaw-dropping. She will be writing something and she will suddenly pivot and address the reader directly, and it's as if a sort of bolt of lightning has just shot through the text. Her technique is bravura. It's just incredible. And I read her stories, and quite often her material is her own life. And she had quite a chaotic life. She battled alcoholism. She had 4 different sons by different men. And she had these relationships and this life where she was moving around and was working as a cleaner and working as a laundrette and very much at the fringes of society and just about getting by. And so in those details, her life bears no relation to mine. But what I got from her, as well as a technique, is the way that she was unafraid to use her life again and again. And she writes so close to the bone that somehow came as such a revelation to me. She's one of those writers that I read at exactly the right time, because I read her around the time that my son was born. And the title story of Multitudes, and it's possibly the most autobiographical thing I've ever written, because he was very ill shortly after birth and we didn't know if he would make it, and we were in and out of intensive wards and hospitals. And something about that gave me a sort of courage. I'd grown up worrying, you know, at the myth of the pram in the hallway, and worried that if you are an artist and once you become a mother, you never write again and you're never able to write again and your work becomes sentimental and all these sorts of things. And then suddenly I felt this huge new courage, which was to do with realizing that it didn't really matter. I didn't really care what anyone else thought. You know, I didn't care what my parents thought. I didn't care what my publishers thought. I just didn't. There was such a freedom in having had an experience like that just diminished everything else. Which of course, you know, say Jung would say, we're still projections anyway, but something about that carried with me, and I was able to write Multitudes, and I was able to go back and write some of the stories that appear earlier in Multitudes, although they were written after the title story, and write them with a new sense of possibility, a new sense of freedom. And so that was very important to me. And that feels like one of those portals that allows you to see yourself, to change, to transfigure the way that you are, the way that you write. And I think that sense, possibly that's important in a writing life that starts early and needs to go on. You know, the changing and the upping stakes and finding new ways to go deeper.
So you were actually referring to Lucia Berlin's A Manual for Cleaning Ladies, was that the one?
Yeah, I was. It's an extraordinary collection, put together posthumously.
Yeah, so a part of your autobiography, so, are the children. And I see that in your acknowledgements, you dedicate the book to your daughter, and it's written especially for all London, particularly Northern Irish, who are in London. Is there a special situation to the Northern Irish in London?
Yeah, it's dedicated to my daughter. When I was pregnant with my son, he's 6 and a half now, so, you know, 7 and a half years ago, there was very little written by contemporary writers on motherhood. I loved Anne Enright's Making Babies, her essays.
Yeah.
And Rachel Cusk had written A Life's Work on becoming a mother. I loved Louise Erdrich as well. I loved reading Toni Morrison's accounts of how she would get up to write before looking after her children, before her working day. There didn't seem to be very much fiction. I happened to have dinner with Lenny Goodings, the Virago publisher, when I was about 6 months pregnant. And we were talking about a book that had originally been published by Virago that I had read in a reissue by Persephone Books, who published neglected or forgotten books by women. Enid Bagnold, I'm not even sure how you pronounce her surname. It's called The Squire. And it's a book, the whole book is about the late pregnancy and giving birth of a woman, a middle-class woman, during the First World War, giving birth to her fifth child. And it's about that sense of closing in and then the child being born. And since then, even in the last sort of half decade, I think there's been a real explosion in women writers writing about pregnancy, writing about birth, writing about the body, writing about all these aspects of female experience. Probably there's just about to be, usefully for me, there'll be a whole swathe of these bold and fearless writers writing about menopause, which is also, that seems to be complete. There seems to be so little written on that. You know, all these aspects of female experience. I was really interested in writing mother-child relationships and writing about how that changes and reconfigures the relationships around you, the relationship to one's own mother, to one's own friends who do and don't have children. For me, it's all about those, you know, the intimacies of all relationships. Mm-hmm. And writing the dedication, Multitudes, was dedicated to my son. And so the sister volume is dedicated to my daughter. I quite like that they're just about to come out in Polish in one volume, both collections together. And I love that idea. I would love them to be published both together. They belong together in so many ways. But yes, this collection, I was thinking, my daughter is called Orla, which is an Irish name, Orla Rose, half English, half Irish. Mm-hmm. And we spelled it. My husband was really keen on having an Irish name for our daughter. And just before I got pregnant with her, I had written my own version of Chekhov's Three Sisters. And the character is Olga, of course, and I had renamed her Orla. And my husband didn't know that name, and he absolutely loved that name. I didn't know at first about calling a daughter after a character. I'd never imagined I would do that. I felt a bit superstitious about it, but he loved the name. And so I think about my daughter with an Irish name growing up in London. And I wonder, I was editing just after she was born my collection of Irish short stories for Faber, in which I tried to really break open what it means to be Irish. And I have stories in that collection by a Chinese-born writer who married an Irishman who she met in New York and moved to Ireland to have their child. I have stories by a writer who was born in Nigeria and came to Ireland as an asylum seeker and raises her daughter in Ireland now. Stories by a Finnish-born writer who moved to Ireland when she was 20, has lived in Ireland for 40 years and is never regarded as an Irish writer. A writer who was born in Birmingham to one Irish and one Jamaican parent, writers who were, and so I was thinking about all these things and thinking about how Irish my daughter, my son, will feel, how entitled to calling themselves Irish they will feel. They have Irish passports by dint of mine, which we're very grateful for, given Brexit and all the rest of it. So they do have Irish passports. They are technically Irish citizens. It's interesting thinking how much they will feel allowed to be Irish. There's a sort of upswell at the moment in Ireland as it becomes more multicultural, as it becomes more diverse. All of the things that I just think make us so much richer. All these different stories, all these different places, all these different influences, all these different people, all these different possibilities. You know, the closest thing I have to an article of faith are the lines from Louis McNeice. You know, I peel and portion a tangerine and spit the pips and feel the drunkenness of things being various. I love that sense of both and rather than either or. Yeah, I called my collection Being Various after that line. But still, there's a sense that there are, you know, people who are more Irish or second class Irish. And I wonder how Irish my children will feel, how Irish they'll choose to feel, how Irish they'll feel allowed to feel. And so the dedication as well is to all London Irish, and particularly London Northern Irish, because I think it's easier to be London Irish or to be American Irish in an uncomplicated way, but Northern Irish is a bit trickier. And so that, yeah, the book is for that experience as well. The stories in the book are possibly like my own experience. People who have moved away, who have found a sort of freedom in London and are now wondering if there's a price for that, if there's a sense of loss that comes with that freedom as well.
The sense of loss can, of course, feed into literature. And I've seen in many of your stories, in the first story, from the first till the last, in both Multitudes and Intimacies, the prominence of fear and how you can overcome fear. That seems to be a main emotion in your stories. Like, for example, in Intimacies itself, the title story, it's all about how love is a counterforce against fear.
Yes, I wanted both of those. I'm so glad you said it and read it like that, because I wanted both collections to start with the fearful and the tautness and to open up, you know, to almost have this euphoric rush at the end. Because that is one of the things that I do believe. I've been interested in religion and spirituality in various ways for all of my life. When I was 13, I corresponded for years with a Buddhist monk. I've been interested in Islam and in Sufi mysticism and Christianity, in so many different religions, in you know, yoga practice, in all these ways in which we experience spirituality. And I do think that there are two forces in the world. There's one, or one can respond to the world through fear, which we're so often prompted to do, and which growing up in a time like Belfast, you certainly did. Or one can choose to respond with love, and love is the stronger. And love and tolerance and trust, that is the only way to respond to the world and to make sense of things. I always think growing up, the greatest insult that you could give when I was a teenage girl was she loves herself.
Yes.
And I think that sense of self-belief, self-worth, faith, self-love being something that was the most scorned, the most feared, the most taboo. You know, that sense of, I think of one of the stories in Multitudes that I wrote, a story very close to my heart, is Here We Are. And it's about two young women who fall in love. And I wrote it came, as stories often do, they quite often have when a few things spark together. You know, there's a sort of alchemy. And one of the places that came from was when the Republic of Ireland had its its equal marriage referendum. And it was expected that older people and more conservative people would vote against gay marriage, and that the younger, more pluralistically minded people would vote for it. But what you found, there were some such moving things where I saw an interview on the news with an elderly woman who must have been in her 80s, quite frail, being taken to vote. And someone said, what was she going to vote? The assumption being that she was going to vote, you know, to uphold societal standards and uphold marriage as something between only a man and a woman, etc. And she said she was going to vote for marriage equality. And when she was asked why, she said, because she had never been able to live the sort of life that she wanted. She'd never been able to love the person and people that she wanted, not just openly, but not at all. And she wanted young people to have the chance to live and love the life that she never had been able to. And gosh, I just found that so incredibly moving, the sense that her whole life had been lived in fear. because of these societal constructs. And she had never been able to love in the way that she wanted to. She'd never been able to live in the way that she wanted to. It was such a stark illustration that there had been love and there had been fear, and fear had overcome the love in her life. And this was her reasserting at the very end of her life the right of love for other people. Such a generous act. And so that, yeah, I'm almost in tears, you know, remembering that. And that made me think of the friends that I had had when I was growing up, male and female, who were gay or who were experimenting with their sexuality, and who felt Belfast was a very, very hard place to be anything, I'm doing quote marks, quote unquote, different when I was growing up. And whether that was a boy wearing eyeliner or wanting to dress ever so slightly differently or flamboyantly, you know, there was very little tolerance for any sort of difference. And so there were friends that I had who were basically disowned by their family for their sexuality, who were sent to religious, re-education camps to straighten out what was perceived as errant sexuality. And so I wanted to write stories like that as well. And the slogan for that marriage equality campaign was "Love Wins." Mm. And I thought, that's the only way, if you grow up in a time and place like Belfast, the only way to counter those fears and a society based on fear and societal rules based on fear is to actively choose love and choose tolerance and choose trust and choose listening and all of those things. And so in both of those ways, I think both of my collections are the moving through, the working out of fear and the act of choosing love.
Yeah, that's absolutely, that you do feel that as a reader. But I was most of all impressed by your story, Inextinguishable, which somehow very concisely, very powerfully combines everything you have just been saying. It's almost a motto for the whole volume, because it's all about hope and living for others in relationships with others, isn't it?
Yes, and a sort of defiance. I think that there is a sort of innocence that comes. People see innocence always as the opposite of experience, you know, innocence as something naive and something childish and something that has to be lost in the world. But I think that there's a different sort of innocence that comes through experience, that is the innocence of being able to hold oneself open and to keep on seeing the world anew and to keep on trusting. When I meet people, one of the great privileges of being a writer is you meet people who have read your stories and they offer their own stories to you, and they tell you stories similar to yours or stories of their own that your stories brought to the surface. You know, sometimes I think when you think what the role of a writer might be in society, and you think back to what the role of the old Irish poets were, you think back to what the roles of shamans in society were, there's a sort of transmuting that happens, you know, that's a sort of taking something that might be dark or painful or repressed and making something of it, you know, transmuting, bringing it up into the light. And maybe by doing that, you're holding the space. And sometimes that's all it is. You can't do the work for anyone else, but you can give a model or you can hold a space in order for them to be able to do that for themselves. And so sometimes people do come to you and they tell you the ways in which your work has helped them or has done that for them. And in a way, you know, it's such a privilege, because in a way you haven't done anything at all. You've worked on your own material or your own whatever, but that has allowed, the creating that space has allowed them the space to transmute something of their own. And I've been offered the most extraordinary stories of things that people have overcome or find a way of still continuing to live after bereavement or after suicide in their family or after these awful events. And the indomitability of the human spirit is something that never ceases to shine through for me. And that story, yeah, that story was an expression of that, an expression of a story. It's not exactly a story that I heard because it's made up, but it's based on a true story that was told to me.
So that's also one of the beautiful things of your fiction. It always filters out the sensation and it keeps the resilience and the real deep strengths of your characters. But I also admired the motto you put in front of Intimacies by Frank O'Hara. And
yes.
And always embrace things, people, earth, sky, stars, as I do, freely and with the appropriate sense of space.
It's beautiful, isn't it? I love that poem. I love Frank O'Hara. I first read him as an undergraduate, you know, when I was 19, my first year of university. And he's one of those poets that I always come back to. And he, something else he says that I almost use for this that I don't, but that I always tell my son is always look up. You know, people always forget to look up. And it's that sense of, yeah, I love that. I mean, we could talk about that epigraph alone for mm-hmm. hours. And it's about, that's one of the things that it is in conversation with the title, because the title is about how close you can be to someone. I found that one of the things about having a child that surprised me the most is that you grow this person inside your own body, and they, in a way, you grow them. There's a poem by the Belfast poet Gail McConnell that I love from her pamphlet Father and Mother, which is, it's all sort of Heaney-esque puns on, and she's a queer poet in a gay relationship, marriage, and she talks about as her partner grew their child in her body, she grew the child in her mind, and she talks about the imaginative act of growing a child being as important as the physical. And I thought about, I love the idea of that. And then you get sort of sideswept by the idea that as soon as your child is born, it's evident they're completely their own person. They are really nothing to do with you at all. They are already there. They are, you know, their spirit, their soul, their personality. It is already there. And so then what you realize that parenthood, it is an act of letting go. So that's there as well as a, you know, that epigraph as a reminder to self of how to, and I suppose we're getting back to, you know, Buddhist ideas of non-attachment, you know, how to love and to honor something whilst realizing that it doesn't belong to you. Yeah, that you are part of the same thing, but you have, you know, intimacy, space is as important. That's a very incoherent answer. Frank O'Hara says it much more beautifully, but yeah, all of those things are there for me when I read those lines.
Yeah, it's also what psychoanalysts say, call the right distance, and you even mention Winnicott at some point.
Yes, I loved reading Winnicott. Winnicott was always one of my favourite psychoanalytical writers, especially in his essay that I found so comforting about being a good enough mother, when he says, and this is, you know, it comes back to the personal worries that I have about balancing writing and children. My own mother gave up work when we were born, and her whole life was looking after us, and it gave us such a lot. And that's something that I won't be able to give to my children, because, you know, I shut the door and I work and I'm not there all the time. But I was thinking about the ways in which for them that is also a healthy model in different ways of, my whole life isn't them. There are things that I need to do aside from them, and there will be a freedom in that for them. And then you read Winnicott and he says, all you need to be is good enough. You need to love them enough, give them enough freedom, look after them enough. But in those gaps, those are the places where both of you fail, and you learn it's okay to fail. And that's an important lesson. And you model how to start again, how not to be devastated the first time something happens to you that makes you realize that you're not perfect, you know. So yes, I'm a huge fan of Winnicott.
Great, yeah. I shouldn't ask you this, but I can't withhold myself. Because you talk about both love and religion in such a beautiful way, they come together a lot in C.S. Lewis's work, who is then again connected to Belfast, isn't he?
Yeah, and do you know what? His house, Little Lee, is just a few houses down from my parents on the street that I grew up on. And I used to walk past it every day on my way to school. And it's a house that contains a wardrobe that inspired Narnia. It's a 1930s built house, similar to my parents. And I used to walk past every day when I was 12 on my way to secondary school. And I always used to feel, I used to have conversations with him in my mind, because I always used to feel he was so unfair to Susan at the end of the Narnia books. Because I always liked Lucy, of course, the best, because she shares my name, and he's a little bit nicer to Lucy in the Chronicles. But Susan, poor Susan, he writes her off very scornfully at the end by saying she's no longer allowed to come into Narnia because she's too interested in, I think he says, lipstick and nylons and invitations. And it always used to make me feel really cross that she was barred and she was dismissed like that. And in fact, I later found a young female fan of the Narnia books, did write to C.S. Lewis and said to him, you know, why did he treat Susan so poorly? And he wrote back to her and he said, if she felt that way, she should take up Susan's story herself and write Susan's story herself. And I always liked that idea that in my world, you can be interested in lipstick and parties and invitations and still be completely welcome in the world of Narnia and still belong to those childhood worlds as well. So yeah, those are some of the conversations I used to have with C.S. Lewis as I walked past his house to and from school.
Well, I love the fact that you wrote your own Through the Wardrobe, which is an absolutely wonderful story. But I'm afraid we will have to round off here. So can I just ask one more question? Is your family going to have some German influences as well in the future? Because we're very glad that you cooperated and contributed to Kaleidoscope 2 on Europe in Ireland. And you said there that your husband might become German.
Well, it's part of this scramble. I think everyone is looking for whatever passports they can that allow them to still be a European citizen at the moment. I mean, the ironies are that, you know, even the most stridently right-wing Brexit, you know, propagandists are looking for the ways in which they and their families can still be European. And yes, my husband, he is still pursuing this. It's been slowed down by the pandemic, but his father's mother came to England as a young child. She was Jewish, half Jewish, and she was smuggled out of increasingly Nazi Germany just before the outbreak of World War II. And she came to Britain as a Jewish child refugee to join her parents. Her father was a communist and he was a painter. His name is Hein Heckroth. He went on, in fact, to win an Oscar for the art direction of the film Red Shoes. And he was married to a Jewish woman. And they left Germany in the 30s and then later were able to smuggle out their daughter. And so because of that, I always think of that when I see all the stories of the migrants, especially the child migrants, trying to reach Britain today. And the awful stories of the deaths in the Channel and the rhetoric and everything that goes on in the very right-wing media. And I think that if she hadn't managed to come over, if she hadn't been accepted and given asylum in England, then my husband's father wouldn't be here, my husband wouldn't be here, my children wouldn't be here. That's always a very sobering thought. But yes, we hope. So far, me and the children are okay to hop on the Eurostar and come to you. So hopefully my husband will be able to join us.
Great. Well, Lucy, thank you very much for your time and for your very insightful comments on your work. We should have talked about your new novel that is going to come out. Is it 2022?
Yes, it's about the Belfast Blitz. And I wrote that, I wrote the first draft of that over the very intense weeks of the first lockdown, March to April, last year, which the Belfast Blitz took place over March to April 1941. So it was a very strange time when this window seemed to open up for me between these two worlds.
Well, we look forward to that book as well. But first of all, we will focus on intimacies, and you're incredible to be so prolific with two children who get all your care. So it's amazing. Thank you very much for this interview, and hope to see you soon.
Yes, I very much hope so. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to our Irish Itinerary podcast. We hope you'll join us again in 2 weeks on Thursday, the 18th of February, when Christoph Reinfand from the University of Tübingen will meet Mary O'Donnell. We want to thank Jerry Smith for allowing us to use his tune Coming Through Sligo as a jingle. And we want to express our sincere gratitude to Culture Ireland, the Department of Foreign Affairs of the Republic of Ireland, as well as the Irish College Leuven, for their continued and generous support of FSIS and of all formats of our Irish Itinerary. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe to the Irish Itinerary podcast, tell your friends about us, and like us in all the social media you are using. Bye-bye!